toned it down slightly, but now I'm going to keep it. There's a lot of background now. Yeah. Okay, I think that'll be good. I don't see any red, and that's the only thing I have to look out for. You know, it's like in the old tape.
Yeah, it's got
fuzz
a
over. Good evening, everyone. Welcome. It's all beginning. We're going to just make a couple announcements beforehand, and John, I think you're going to start.
Thank you, Aaron. Good evening, everybody. Thank you for coming this evening. My name is John McInerney. Just a brief introduction to how we all got to be here. Last year, 2010, the Athens Cultural Center lent its support and encouragement to me to organize the first Bloomsday event here in Athens. Quite a successful event, I think. We managed to raise some money for this wonderful institution here in Athens to keep it here, first of all, and also to help it to continue to open its arms to the arts and culture community in this area, and to respond to that community, most importantly. We hope to do the same thing again this year. We're going to have another Bloomsday event on Bloomsday on Flag Day again, when we'll have fireworks. Our wonderful friends in Hudson have a great fireworks display on Flag Day, and you can see that from the Riverfront Park in Athens. Our event here, another Bloomsday reading, will take place from 4 p.m. to 6 p.m., as it did last year. The schedule's the same. I encourage anybody who wants to read to get in touch with me. I'll be floating around here. You can approach me later on, get my email, and so on and so forth. And we like to have lots of readers. But that event was significant for other reasons. One of them was that, as I said, we raised some money for the center. It was also the first event at which a lot of people came from all over this area who were lovers of literature, writers, and readers. It also provided an opportunity for us to meet and talk about the possibilities of developing something further in the literary vein. And this evening is actually the first event in a series of readings. Rebecca Wolf and Ira and Sam Truitt and I conversed about it, and those guys took the ball and ran with it. And that's the reason that you're all here this evening. So a big thanks to Ira and Rebecca and Sam for all the work they put in on bringing this event to fruition. Again, 12th of June, 4 to 6, Bloomsday again on Flag Day. Athens will have a lot of things to do. We've got new businesses opening, Cameos expanding, a brew pub up the street. Stewart House will be open again, hopefully. So come, bring your friends, family, have a great time. But most of all, come and support the Athens Cultural Center. And thank you all very much.
Announce just a couple short things before we get to the meat of the program here. There are two events coming up. One is the Locke Oates Duo. This is going to be a jazz performance. It's on Sunday or Saturday, next Saturday, the 22nd. And that's at 8 p.m. here. And there'll be a pre-performance talk at 7 p.m. It should be really wonderful. They're a great duo. So if you want to come out and see them. And then the following Saturday, which is Memorial Day, I guess, May 29th at 8 p.m., there is prom night at the Populous Barn. It will be a dance. It will be a lot of fun. If you haven't already bought your tickets for it, please get your tickets soon. The admission is $15 in advance, $25 at the door. And so if you know you're going to want to come that night, you might as well get your tickets in advance. So we're going to start tonight. We have three spectacular readers tonight. We have Lynn Tillman, Brenda Coltis, Christopher Stackhouse. We're going to start with Lynn. Lynn Tillman's most recent novel is American Genius, a comedy. Her most recent collection of stories, This Is Not It. She writes novels, stories, essays, and has begun work on her next novel, provisionally titled Clouds and Apparitions, which she plans to finish within her lifetime. In early 2011, Red Lemonade, a new press, will publish a new collection of her short stories, which is titled Someday This Will Be Funny. She is the fiction editor of Fence Magazine and teaches at UAlbany. Please, everyone, give a big, big welcome.
Usually the fiction writer reads last, but I asked to read first to reverse things. Yeah, I am going to read the beginning of a new novel, and it is called Clouds and Apparitions, and I'll just read the first 13 and a half pages, which begins, "The end doesn't depend on the beginning. There's a story in my family about great-uncle Charlie who didn't know until he was 18 and married to Margaret that women went to the bathroom. It's always told with that euphemism. My father, whose Uncle Charlie was, told it to my older brother when he was 13, then me at 13, a father-son rite of passage, and his three brothers told their three sons, and then their daughters when they loosened up about girls. My kid sister, Clover, the baby and girl in our nuclear tribe, was named after a minor league historical figure on my mother's side, her great-great-great-great-great someone. Historical Clover had a tragic end. Mom liked the name, gave it to her baby girl because of the connection to the past, attached to it in a mystical way, she said. I thought it was creepy, given the provenance, but you can't argue with mysticism. You just need to know your enemy. For a long time, I stayed out of all that or tried to be objective. That was when I had hope for objectivity. But the mind is weaker than the flesh. Just kidding. My father didn't know much about his genealogy, his people, if he has one. I'm paraphrasing Franz Kafka. My father's misbegotten clan arrived on a ship early in the 19th century and made their way, the usual deal, fourth generation not only doesn't refer to the old country but also doesn't ever think about it. Brothers became professionals, sisters married well. My mother thinks she is American. Her family arrived on the Mayflower with the criminal's mother, the religious crackpot's mother. Man, she gets pissed. We were poets, feminists, abolitionists, politicians, she says. Her Boston people hung with the Henry James crowd. But when she came of age, she let family privilege go, which was part of her privilege. Image was a personal issue for my mother. The way I put it, it was in the family as ancestor worship. And she knew herself as an image from birth, distanced or not. Her family's house was decorated with ancestral portraits painted by respectable English and American painters, and later on 19th century photographers. Mother was our family photographer until I was 8 and she gave me a cool camera. My mother owned a Zeiss Icon and my father liked his Polaroid. He bought the first camera in 1962. But in 1982, Kodak launched disc photography, the easy-to-use, decision-free cameras built around a rotating disc of film. Mom bought me that. It was cool and fussy, primitive now. I loved it. But I was more interested in bugs and rockets then. At about 12, I went crazy for photography. When I was a kid, I didn't kill cats or torture small animals, except my sister. She thinks I tortured her. Tormented is closer. When I was 6, I found ecstasy in our backyard. A praying mantis appeared. I didn't know what it was, but it rocked my world. I watched its little head turning on its neck, the only insect on earth that turns its head like a person. They're dinosaur humans. Praying mantises have a face and look you in the eyes. Their eyes are in the middle of their tiny heads, and they see the way we do. So cool. The PM noticed me and looked right at me. I thought I was face to face with a god or an alien. E.T. is a praying mantis. The praying mantis really took me in. It was sympathy and intelligence. I wanted him for a pet, for a friend, and named him Mr. Petey. My parents wouldn't let me bring him indoors. I could talk to him. It could have been female. He listened better than my parents, and pretty much every day I went into the backyard to find him. Petey usually showed up. I never touched him. You can't kill a praying mantis, my mother said huffily. They're a protected species, and if you kill one, we'll have to pay the government a lot of money. I wasn't ever going to kill Petey. She was crazy. But learning about the existence of a protected species thrilled my kid brain. It still does. I wondered if I was one, a special boy with special powers, because I knew Mr. Petey. I reveled in those notions, talking with Mr. Petey. You can't find a praying mantis stuffed animal, so I made drawings, and my mother sewed me one. I still have it. Petey's head flops down after all these years. Mr. Petey has seen it all. Mr. Petey, plural. I didn't know then that she lives only a year. A praying mantis's short lifespan fundamentally defies the value of human longevity, its evolutionary merit, the flaws therein. I must have fooled myself. Actually, I don't think kids fool themselves. When a new praying mantis showed up, because their markings and color vary. I don't know what I thought, but a praying mantis showed up in the spring and stayed through the summer. I called him, her, Mr. Petey, and then one day he went for a vacation in the South. I figured that out for myself. And that was always Mr. Petey in the backyard until I left home. I was a dreamy kid. I'm not so dreamy now. Maybe I am still, but in a different way. And my dreaminess is more blocked to me. Or it was until recently. Anyway, I had dreamed about being a medical doctor because of Uncle Lionel. He told me people wore green uniforms in the hospital. I figured he jumped around in the halls like a big insect, the way he did in our house. Older Bro Hart went into medicine, so that got taken. When Uncle Lionel was drunk, he lunged at the couch, collapsed, and slept like the dead until he was pulled off by Aunt Marcy. My father drank too, but held it better, and he was an estate lawyer. There were other sibs, Charlie, Theodore, Lila, Diane, but Lionel was 2 years younger than Dad. They were very close and almost didn't need to talk, but they did every day on the phone in some kind of code. Somehow, Lionel loved my father. I don't think the others did or do. Lionel was the clown in the family, so maybe a sense of the ridiculous came to my father's aid. Loving my father had to be absurd. Lionel took the big hit, a one-time muscle-destroying heart attack. My miserable father went battling esophageal cancer. Through his breathing tube, Dad spat out his last words to me. Nothing spiritual from an estate lawyer. Get your money out of the market. I almost forgave him for that later. I'm so getting ahead of myself. One, I'm slowing down now. Two, this is not a good time in my life, in most ways not. Three, it could also be exciting if it were not my life. Four, I studied other people's lives and customs. That's why I'm a cultural anthropologist. But then things shifted and I became my own subject too. A soft science, Hart says. Not putting it down, little bro. He's 4 years older and a forensic pathologist. Right, big bro, I say, and you see dead people. Actually, dead people have a lot of currency in our family. Our family house was a 1960s large split-level ranch, 4 bedrooms, parents on one end, children the other, bedrooms the same size for Hart and me, and baby sister Clover, but hers had more windows, a raw point, and walls of picture windows in the living room and dining room areas, slate floors, an open kitchen with an island, floor-to-ceiling stone fireplace, and we were sort of in the country, outside Boston, near Beverly. Nice family place, if you didn't know the family. Just kidding. My parents told us stories of their upbringings up to the point where they couldn't make sense of them or why they were telling them, which reminded them they shouldn't have had children. Three of us. So maybe because of that, they underlined their gene carriers' exceptionalism without evidence and bestowed on us unique monikers. I'm Ezekiel, sixth century prophet, Huber, maternal surname, Stark, paternal German, Jewish, English, Unitarian. In grade school, Zeke was yucky, Stark, sucky, rhymed with everything. Brother Hart Starks, same rhymey biz, but he glories in it, imagines he's special, like Hart Crane, the writer, but he's a pathologist. And poetry isn't analyzing diseased cells, though he'd make the case for a strong relationship. Our Clover, Clover Sturgis Hooper Stark, doesn't say anything about her handle or if she suffers because of its sad legacy, now I do, because she has selective mutism. She can talk, but she doesn't want to, so she chooses to be silent or she doesn't. It's debatable. These days, I more and more understand her, even if she is a drag and sort of blames me for talking too much when we were kids and not giving her a chance. Probably true. She was born 4 years after me, and from my point of view, messed things up more. She's a huge presence. Cultural anthropology, in the branch I mostly do, ethnology, isn't a 19th century discipline anymore. There can be a rigor toward methodology, but the question of subject-object relationships and objectivity itself, that's challenged. It's in tatters from my point of view. And it's divided the discipline. Sure, you can reflect on differences and see patterns and gather information, but what you study is as much about you as them, or them isn't a them. You begin thinking, why am I interested in this aspect of culture? What is my stake in this? And there you go. Even if you go far away, I mean travel physically, the world is way too connected and a hut on an island has Wi-Fi. And you take you with you. You're not Gauguin with native women living a primitive life. You're not Margaret Mead, great and wild as she was, studying the Samoans who knew the game and lied to her. Native informant, not innocent informant. It's obvious, but the most obvious stuff wasn't 40 years ago and some social scientists still go nuts. I'm happier this way, really. I can't escape myself, but I have to factor bits of myself in. I study myself and my male peer group. I study the role of images in contemporary life, especially families. I'm part of my family, and there goes objectivity. And like the rest of the world, I take photographs and collect them. Other people's albums, anonymous others, images and incidents gather in lives. Some events are coincidences, what we plan and what we think we do. We don't know their consequences either. You never can, which was why exactly I did things that others could call idiotic. Hart does and did regularly. In my aleatoric mind, I took chances to test myself and shake things up. I have rich, unsettled patterns of mind. I hate routines. But I have them, everyone does. I have rituals and habits, but I don't want to be them, so I change up, shift positions, play second base when I'm usually the shortstop. Maybe I'm a utility infielder. I'm into utility, utilization, effectiveness. My mother says I have my personality from birth, but my character emerged later. My family have strong opinions. They're principled, stubborn, righteous, judgmental. Reasonable, smart, assholes, bigots, or whack jobs, depending upon your point of view and linguistic code. Along with Mr. Petey, other small creatures, outer space, rockets, and the sky, especially cloud formations, the family photos, home movies, and videos were my early obsessions, and I took to classifying them and preserving them. My library was formative, a secret world only I understood, the system. Martin Scorsese says preservation is filmmaking. Think about how much of existence goes into preserving what could instantly disappear and maybe should. Like taking a photo at a wedding, good or bad. Which is important, the moment or the preservation? Actually, I never wanted to be anything. I wanted to stay a kid. That would be my job. I could have become a pedophile, but I didn't. I'd shout at my parents who didn't shout, so I was scary to them. I'm not going to grow up and be you, but I'm 37 and did grow up, technically. Emotionally immature, my mother says. Clover smiles faintly. Pisses me off, but so what? I know I shouldn't have children. I sort of fell into science because of insect interest and cameras and because of a supercharged madman high school biology teacher, Mr. Adams. He had a purple scar across his forehead from fighting in Vietnam, hand-to-hand combat. That's what I pictured. Biology, math, chemistry, the war, and test tubes. There he was at the front of the classroom, tall, strong, bald, his head framed by the green board, his purple scar scarlet in the sunlight. Not a hero, exactly, but close enough. Mr. Adams. And somehow, there was a family connection. My dissertation, You're a Picture, You're Not a Picture, was published when I was 29. Hotshot assistant professor, Brother Hart says. I'm almost an associate, or could be. Teasers are cowardly sadists. Hart's bad enough, but some asshole's married into the family. Nothing to do about in-laws, but despise and ignore them. I studied how families picture themselves, what that picturing implies. Plus, I theorized from what I inferred as an ethnologist about those picturings. I rely on James Clifford and also Irving Goffman, especially indebted to Goffman's gender advertisements and stigma, and the other symbolic interactionists, because they understood society through its smallest gestures, conversation, for instance. I argued that a family photo album is a silent conversation. In our time, image has infiltrated every layer of life, every bit of culture. It's the basis of culture. So it's really hard to pull it out from how we see and act. One of the points I make with my students is that a family's implicit contract is to keep its secrets. They're essential to the kinship bond, which offers protection at a price, loyalty to blood and brood. What happens in the family stays there. No obedience, no protection. I use various media to explain certain phenomena and enduring characteristics, as well as new adaptations of the American family. For example, mafia movies succeeded after the family was hammered during the 60s by promoting oaths that, like marriage, were till death do you part, while guilt and criminality occurred only by disregarding the family, not the law. Hollywood and even indie movies glorified the thug's loyalty to the Klan, but HBO's The Sopranos portrayed mob boss Tony Soprano's sadism so graphically that Sunday by Sunday the viewer's sympathy was shredded. But other genres will fill the emptiness film. There will be no end to war stories for an age of permanent war, and with the cry for blind patriotism, an American's fidelity to family can be converted into an uncritical devotion to country. My thoughts are coming on now, hard to differentiate one from the other, like jets scrambling. Some nights I've been mad, my brain slammed. Hard to explain, control impossible, bleeding in my brain pan, into a bursting that wasn't a bursting. Rage against the machine or the family. At 15, I wanted to kill everyone, especially Hart and my father. Then I was told I was a teenager, and that's normal. Each time I look at my mother in her teenage scrapbook, pictures of her when she was 9, I gape. She says I'm obsessive or a nutcase, depending on her mood. I say, you can say that less pejoratively. How about impassioned? Time passes in looking, I don't know how long. What's that expression, what she's thinking, what was happening in her, and the same fantasy hits my screen. I might see her static face move, speak, explain herself to me. In the home videos, when my father sits at the head of the table at holidays, I see his contempt and malevolence and despise him even more. The few photographs I shot of him he hated, he said I made him look bad, that he didn't look like that, and tore them up in front of me. It's evidence of his enduring, irrational aggression to me. While I was teaching, I won't say when, I was an agent for the U.S. Post Office. 2 years of being a domestic spy, lost mail, late mail, line standing, the incompetence and stupidity of my post office station had pissed me off for years. I have stood on a line with increasingly furious people for 2 hours. So when I was asked in an official letter from the USPS in D.C. to cooperate in a study about making the system better, I went for it. There wasn't much to it. I had to telephone a special number and record the mail I received using their code numbers, the number of pieces in any day, and the exact date I received the test mail, as the USPS called it. If I didn't know the date it had arrived, let's say I had been away for 2 days, there was a problem. That particular test mail wouldn't count. I couldn't approximate, I had to know for sure, and be honest. Honesty is usually wasted effort. So I was, because I wanted to nail the USPS, and I wouldn't need to lie to do it. Mail came almost every day, all kinds of envelopes. I had to phone a telemarketing firm with my agent number, pun punching it in or speaking it into the machine, I get a recorded message and answer the simple questions, pressing number one or two. But sometimes there are additional problems, like my having been away for more than 2 days, when I was supposed to have let them know 2 weeks in advance if I were going away. I didn't live that way. I often didn't know my comings and goings until I went and returned. Then my uncertainty about a letter's actual delivery date forced me to speak with an actual person, because there was a problem, and it wasn't straightforward. If I called after midnight when I came home from a club or bar, it was more complicated. The mail had by then actually arrived the day before, so instead of pressing number one for today, I had to hit the keys for yesterday's date, which meant I had to know the date. I didn't sometimes, or it was physically hard to press the keys. It was a long night, maybe. My eyes weren't focusing right. It was easier just to press the number one key for today, but that meant every night I needed to get home before midnight. Often I couldn't or forgot, and then there was that annoying end-of-day duty I'd voluntarily pledged to do. It was a simple job. Anyone who could read, hear, and count could do. But after 2 years, I'd had it. Being civic-minded and responsible was a drag. Civil servility for zip. The post office will never get better. It's over. Old technology can't compete. And it wasn't built to compete. And it's not environmentally friendly. Post office stations destroy neighborhoods. But I couldn't return the test mail that the USPS mailed through its telemarketing facility from my own zip code area. They mailed me large self-addressed stamped manila envelopes folded inside smaller ones, and I was supposed to return certain pieces of test mail in their envelopes. Everything was disguised, people's names, mailing addresses from Florida, Minnesota, England, all fakes. But they were uniform, same names and addresses every time. I could tell exactly what was what, and the demented civil servants in our mail disaster station could too. So agents were supposed to return the test mail every few weeks. This meant we had to go through piles of mail from several months and find the right pieces to check off on their list and place those pieces in the envelope. More of a drag. I had piles of mail waiting to be purged, but once I got word, I had to shred the irrelevant letters or in some way disguise it. I don't have a shredder and don't want one. I'd spill ketchup and mustard on the mail. I don't think Richie, the mail carrier, or any of the other mail carriers were waiting guard at the garbage cans. If one was, he or she wouldn't want to get messed up. That's what I counted on, a sort of propriety, the need to stay clean. But I didn't really appreciate desperate acts then. I'm not a suspicious-looking character. I was trained by my status-weary parents to bleed in. T-shirt or long-sleeve shirt, black jeans, dark jacket, voluntary uniform. When I was required to carry mail into another zip code zone, I became aware, one, of how many mail carriers there are, and two, that any border crossing, inner or outer, is a fragile entity, invested with power or not, and three, ancestors and intentions are no cover story. I became sensitive about how I might appear to others. Crossing over, I slowed down, like this is hyperbolic, walking through nothing to declare at customs. I could get that into the novel. I slowed down, like this is hyperbolic, walking through nothing to declare at customs, and wondering what is something to declare. Then in that second, that delay, I knew I was betraying what I did feel guilty about that could get me stopped, like in a shrink's office, where you stop. I haven't been stopped at customs recently, not since I was 20 and had no sense about legality and treachery at border crossings. It will happen again, obviously. Transnational class race profiling coming soon to your neighborhood. Often no agents are standing around, nothing or something declare because FBI have done their work before. You're on a list, so you would have been stopped earlier, supposedly. Ends up no one's there. I download the guilt anyway, which doesn't register on their screens. Then there are all these people standing outside waiting for something. I really feel nuts after a dogish flight, dead, and then boom, fluorescent lights, expectant faces. Could it be you after 20 years? You are parading on a catwalk in the human fashion show. I'll take that one. No, that one's not right. No, that's more like him. The concept of family resemblance is reasonable given genetics, but it's peculiar because what makes a resemblance isn't clear. There's no feature-by-feature similarity. Most of us in families share a resemblance. Fascination with the family other, a neologism I coined from my first book. is dulled by the others being related by blood. Yet what's near can be farther. What's in the mirror is farther than you think. Because up close, we're less able to see each other. I don't look like my brother, but everyone says I do. I hate my brother. Often we hate our siblings. So a family resemblance colludes against your difference, against your will. Blood tells a story, it seems to say, of which you are a part, and like tragedy, can't be escaped. Thank you.
Collaborative book Seismosis, 1913 Press in 2006, which featured his drawings and philosophical discourse with text by co-author poet fiction writer John Keane. He has a book of poems forthcoming in 2011 from Counterpath Press, and a book of collected prose forthcoming in 2011 from Sandpaper Press, which is down in Key West. Could everyone give a big welcome to Christopher Stackhouse? This radical disintegration of parts, squeals, gesture, erasure, assertive, tearing away or open a hole in the scene, the grid everybody sees to be vulgar, mass and volume, flesh is modular, peeling back themselves, reduced to an immense silence, a thick mucus in the throat, proxy for pedigree, all pleasure being equal. You are not supposed to look good if you have desire, the best guess trapped beneath surface tension. Cursive against cursive, seminal, in the plain air, crossfade, taxi, unmade, stretched, contractible, catching light in the pass, staving dissension, becoming a part, what seems to be nothing, this is what happens. Now, I want to say one other thing that I normally don't qualify these things. However, there's the word taxi in here, and every person that's ever read these or heard these say, oh, I love the yellow taxi in the poem. It's not a noun, it's actually the verb, to taxi. So think of it as an activity, as an action, as opposed to a stasis, a stable noun. This radical disintegration of parts, squeals, gesture, erasure, assertive, tearing away, or open a hole in the scene, the grid everybody sees to be vulgar, mass and volume, flesh is modular, peeling back themselves, reduced to a thick mucus in the throat, proxy for pedigree, becoming a part, all pleasure being equal, you are not supposed to look good if you have desire, X or face in a bubble, or nosing in on its contour, turning away from nothing, the best guess trapped beneath surface tension, cursive against
cursive, seminal in the plain air, crossfade, taxi, unmade, stretched, contractible, catching light in the pass. This radical tearing away of parts, squeals, gesture, erasure, assertive, opening a hole in the scene, the grid everybody sees, becoming a part of all pleasure being equal. You are not supposed to look good if you have nothing, desire, X, or face in a bubble, or nosing in on its contour, turning away from the best guess trapped beneath cursive against cursive. Piper, blow, blow hard in the plain air, crossfade, taxi, unmade, stretched, contractible, tension catching light through the wreck, approximate, devilish, burgundy, pressed to function, throat, instrumental to itself in the and serial. X or face in a bubble or nosing in on its contour, V-shaped, pointing from to the best guess trapped beneath surface tension, seminal to be vulgar, mass and volume, flesh is modular, peeling back themselves, tearing away or open a hole in the scene, the grid everybody sees, reduced to a thick mucus in the throat. Proxy for pedigree, becoming a part, all pleasure being equal. You are not supposed to look good if you have desire, visceral, in the plain air, crossfade, taxi, unmade, stretched, contractible, catching light through the wreck, instrumental to itself, in the and serial. In the plain air, crossfade, taxi, unmade, stretched, contractible, catching light through the wreck, bursting surface, pus left in the V-shape, your excellence for the time being, forget about moving forward, it tastes, it's been real, by, it matters, all pleasure being equal, mass and volume, flesh is modular, instrumental to itself, nosing in on its contour, cursive against cursive, turning away from, trapped beneath, peeling back, next, left open a hole in the grid everybody sees, reduced to a thick mucus, an immense silence, torn from field, lost a tail dispatched, lone trace for seconds caught intact. This is what happens in the plain air, stretched, contractible, catching light through the wreck, bursting surface, trapped beneath another face unmade, pus left in your form, your excellence, all pleasure being equal, its contour, torn from field, instrumental to itself, becoming distinction, reduced to throat, what seems to be open alone, fill in, pause, service condition, nosing in on, desire, lost a tail, dispatched for seconds, returned in grammar, tension's bow into curve, flesh on paper, cursive against cursive, needle to square, lean, vital, read into parenthesis, etymon, further, what you want more than want. To be vulgar, mass and volume, throat, flesh, open, alone, catching light, bow into cursive, read into parentheses, bursting in plain air, your form trapped beneath its contour, becoming distinction, seed square into circle, all pleasure being apparition, instrumental to itself, in part score, corrections, thinking off, flesh on paper, desire lost on surface, vital, chained, turning, circa, removed, evenly brooked all by myself, recessed, looks back, undertone, what seems to be left, service condition, paragraph, crystal, against cursive, indexed enough, perfectly soft when born. And then there's, I wanted to take a minute to read some prose. There's a, as part of the rotating, ongoing rotating pool of faculty at the Naropa, the Jack Kerouac School of Disembodied Poetics. I was there last year, and intense thing if you've ever done it. Some of you might have done it, taught there. You know, you teach for 15 hours in the course of basically 5 days. And some of my students I got really close with, and one of them called me the other day and she said, you know, I just wrote Bernadette Mayer and asked her what conceptual poetry is, and she started laughing. And she's like, I want to know, like, you know, you seem to have a conceptual bent to your work, so I want to ask you some questions, and, you know, if you have time, answer. If you don't, you know. But so I answered. So I'm going to read her questions and my answers. And it's sort of long, but no longer than that. The first question she asked was, what do you think conceptual writing is? And pardon my reading, because I've never read this aloud, and this is from an email, actually. C.S. I really have no idea what conceptual writing is. From a philosophical standpoint, a concept functions essentially between and around truth and falsity. The conceptual is related to abstraction, which in my mind has something inherent to do with possibility, i.e., what could be. In art, visual art specifically, per se, a so-called conceptual aspect in the work is one that has readable potential, which may present some legibility in an actual present object in its material, but does not function independent of the mind in active discursive thought, separate, perhaps devoid of any sensuality, which seems to me totally impossible. As far as writing is concerned, the conceptual in its most radical operation is difficult to really determine or to parse. In visual art, which has traditional basic skill sets and prerequisites, material handling, technical ability, sensual appeals to the beautiful, etc., conceptualism becomes idea-based as opposed to being grounded purely in the attributes of a two- or three-dimensional object. With tangible properties, that is, the idea is ultimately more important than the physical object that represents the idea in poetics. In the idea. In poetics, conceptual writing could well mean any writing text that has no inherent narrative impulse, something that treats language, grammar, syntax, letter symbols, lexeme, grapheme, text, vocalizations, phoneme, speaking, etc., purely as material and or media about which projection of ideas and feelings in the moment of encounter are of far greater importance than whatever conventional language aspects and the presumable conveyance or transfer of knowledge. Several kinds of hybridized or cross-genre literary efforts can do also fall into the category of conceptual writing, and this sort may import conventions of the given language or languages it's written in. This sort may also want to transmit knowledge and facts, as well as simultaneously seek to transport reader imagination with essential metaphor. I have always argued that the purest form of conceptualism in the visual arts world would be the written idea or set of ideas for which the subject and content might project or refer to a physical object to be made, or physical space created, or the ghost of physical sensations to be felt. However, these things never made, leaving a reader or viewer's desire suspended in the possibilities of their own imagination. All manner of writing, minus the heading of conceptualism, does this, or at least can. 2. What is the main difference, in your opinion, between conceptualism in writing and in the visual arts, besides the obvious difference of medium? I think attempted to broach defining a distinction between the two in my last answer. However, the basic difference in the context of conceptualism is that visual art in contemporary terms has no substantial, all-encompassing, unifying lexicon. Conceptualist engagement in visual art has more associative possibilities, is apt for a fuller range of interpretation, and is also at the same time very much dependent on verbal and written language as expository component instrument. In writing, the effort is to free itself from the strictures of denotation, grammar, syntax, all manner of systematic rule and logic structure of language constructions. That doesn't mean anyone practicing so-called conceptual writing wants to or has to discard conventions and functional principles, but rather be aware of purposeful misuse, distortion, and interrogation of a given language form, its construction, or constructive parts. Visual art is less imposing on thought forms than the language we speak and write in. In writing, there are many possibilities, networks of associations, but language in the mind and speaking communication are media of very practical value for survival, in fact. And so I think the displacement of that function is more difficult to achieve, and when it is achieved, with even a modicum of success, it is or can be immediately deemed more rebellious, more revolutionary, artistically, if not socially or politically speaking, making it harder to meaningfully do and harder to accept by others when performed. I say this because this kind of shift helps break thought patterns which are exploited and used to control individual thoughts and interpretations of the world. Learning a language is a rigorous training and or conditioning of the thoughts. Rigorous training and or conditioning of the mind to a particular world view. The conceptual shift in writing is more portable, but more difficult because writing, especially creative writing, as in poetics, is already incredibly abstract. Words themselves are stand-ins for unseen meaning, which constantly contextually shift. The physical properties of objects in art present aesthetic principles that must be dealt with before what is represented, before metaphors imparted, before meaning arise. Meaning in word language is inherent. Meaning in the language of visual art interpretation and experience is not completely necessary. Visual art, conceptual or not, does not necessarily or inherently have to mean anything. In the last section, 3. Why do you think conceptual writing or conceptual poetry is something that is being discussed in literary communities nowadays, particularly the avant-garde? Is it indicative of a new wave of poetic aesthetics, or is this just a new name for an old dog? Does it have anything to do with artists, writers working in multiple genres, or the art world's effect on writing? C.S. Conceptual writing, or conceptual poetry, seems to be an umbrella term for a range of types of writing practices that don't neatly fit into the dominant literary categories. Within this variety, there are aspects of various types of writing performance. Dada, fluxus poetry, asymmetric writing, flarf, which is essentially found poetry and collage, spoken word, concrete poetry, all manner of indeterminate engagements with and among other poetries, many of which yet to be independently titled, but that might fall under this rubric. There is a felt need among practitioners to secure and trellis these diverse poetics with some kind of theoretic underpinning, something scientific or scientific seeming, to imply some kind of seriousness. Many of the now subcategories of so-named conceptual writing are simply types of writing and types of poetry that, yes, have been around for some long time. What has changed are technological means of telecommunication, which have introduced slightly more innovative ways to experiment in writing. I don't think there is any need to apologize, make excuses for, or create some scaffold to principle organic drives and uses of whatever is available to make art with. In this case, write with. I don't know why there is such a focus on concept and theory in poetry. In some ways, I feel like the practitioners don't trust themselves. Writers, artists sometimes need to create spaces of affirmation, even if only self-affirming. More than anything else, that's what this activity of prematurely and at times perversely naming poetics is. And then just a few poems, and I'll move out of the way. I'm going to read these really fast. Okay.
Okay.
started this horrible poem the other day, and I'm going to read it because it's not done. I set these like restraining things on myself. I said, like, oh, now I'm really into these eight songs. I got eight stanzas or eight lines. Everything I write down, I'm going to try to deal with this eight. Sometimes I fail, and the failures are good, or I like them. This was weird. Vincent Katz sent out a call for poems for Vanitas, and I said, oh man, yeah, I'll send you some stuff. And then I said, hold on, let me send you this poem. And then I went to send it to him, and I thought I was attached it, and it wasn't there. And then he said, Stackhouse, there's no poem here. And I said, oh, I'm sorry. So the call for Latin poetry, or poems that are influenced by Latin. And then I realized that I had published a poem in The Recluse. And I was like, oh man, I wrote him back and said, I've already published this, I'm gonna start something else. So I had some little lines jotted down, and this is a half-assed effort right here, but I'm gonna read it anyway. Vis-a-vis curricula per pro forma, mere gesticulation to reverb, to chorus, multiplex fora, inter beings, protostasis reciprocal, for or against verses, word placed, obstacle, stand in for, verge, ensuite, et to vamp with limitation. And that's that. It's not done. And then there's just a bunch of poems that are, a couple of poems that are kind of finished, not quite some sort. This poem is not done, but I want to read it because it's new stuff anyway. It's called 4-1 to Bill Dixon. Do you guys know Bill Dixon? He's a BAM musician, and BAM meaning, for those of you that know, Black Arts Movement, a musician. And the first time I experienced him was watching a movie called Imagine the Sound. And it was Paul Blay, Archie Shepp, Cecil Taylor, and Bill Dixon. I loved him so much, so I went out and bought all these Bill Dixon CDs. And somebody, again, gave me, said, hey, you want to publish a jazz poem? We're only publishing poems by poets who haven't written a jazz poem since 1990. That was the setup. So I haven't written a jazz poem ever. So I started writing this one. It's called 4-1 to Bill Dixon. Bill Dixon plays solo a lot, and one of my favorite albums of his, I forget where he was. He was in Italy and went into one of the cathedrals there, and I think Rome or something. And he brought his son with him, and there's these echoes, and his son is like chanting with him and making noises, and he's responding with just the trumpet, and he's playing the trumpet. So while I listened to that while I was writing this stuff. There's my kid. 4-1, sharp, echo, emphatic, building, air, chambered, recall, disappearance, at once, everything. Who can be everything in calculus, centripetal station, writing itself into inert blur, tender lessons retrieved out of the bottomless gold rings, stacked, Teflon figures, deformed, turned, outish, surplus contiguity, a trillion, be it impossible pleasures, cry perfections, delayed, talons clasp, elusive shine, weathering steel pupils, devouring stars, falling impressible as warm bodies, sparks, molten metals from an ascending rocket, whistle pickle. For the unbeautiful, oneself, systema, chroma, various literacies, friendship under silver luster of cold river, crackling light and hearth, black secretions, maneuver as in glass darkly. Yes, romantic, devastating, split lip, window, unfortunate cigarette, better, time, wind, or other disproportions, before coming, other music missing there, as listened to, perhaps meaning as, always same thing, particular thirst, repetitions, in real-time isolation, gift of blackness, some light upon such to center, each step encounters, sadness open, screech, flutter, luxuriant ecstasies, sun wheel, cerebrations, irreal, regardless, and whim, to resist silence after music, slithering viper at risk. And still working there. they want to sit in a room together. The artists want to sit in a room together, talk and not talk about the wars around them. In the fashion of artists, they sip, nibble, pine for argument's sake, the variations of yellow. Today, a bourgeois moment, each protean connoisseur howls a coloratura, promising not to forget photos of the amputee and erotic thong. Their bricolage forged, available in unlimited editions. The critic loves, actually, yeah, but it does. Your drawings carry the traces of something personal, interesting, the kinds of things people will want to see when you're dead, tapped into, exhumed, a delight really, an affair of looking at positions of the stylus to the surface during the course for creation, the outlaw act imposed, ghost before the dead, principally entails anything, anyone, relative, for instance, can use devices such as the openness of determination between forms, present, alive, and watching. The nose or boats. Intellect plays in the nose, rarefied, undecorated, primer, not quite a brown rat, with all plainness, the idea, making things crank, antiphonic, anticipates boats. That ting in ear might be tinnitus or buzz of endless talk, gas lit, a disconnected kiss, anthracitic distillate to weigh against, animation so cold, it's hot white at the bottom of the flame, clear, there is dead, and there is this afloat. For one chance at this thick warp, variation yields to force. And two more. No, actually three more. I want to read this one. And then this I really barred while I was there. And some of you are from Bard, so you kind of can understand this maybe. But this is an MFA poem from Bard. You know, there are MFA poems out there. Just generated from the MFA program. $50,000 poem here. Caucus. Engine kin, you mean that brown crusty stuff, meaning paint told in forming whole, miraculous apparition, a bear in a pink bunny suit, man oh man, lost in application synonym, crisp in the venue, this auditorium where listening happens, it's the doggerel, kitty cat, a crystal flute, a magnum filled with Krug, ever have it, a firing tank in a field of flowers, azalea in milk jars, wet pickles, flip-flops, some platonic kiss in hand, by-the-by roars, ordinary, I guess I miss your penmanship. Recall Caligula, or the softer Thomas Jefferson. Once, in a coon's age, a tower falls where a sage sleeps, covered to the neck in rubble, punk. The, madam, the article, a type of scarf, perhaps one parasol and a son of parataxis. And I love that poem because I, you know, I got to put Azalea. Remember the song Azalea? I love the Louis Armstrong version of it, so that was in my head. And I got Plato, Caligula, Thomas Jefferson, like all in the same poem, which is relatively impossible to do under normal circumstances. Only at Bard. All right. And so, this is, this is the last two, and this one right here, I actually wrote at the Sherwood Wolf home, which is not far from here, Christmas, they invited me over, and I had to interview at MLA for something, so I had to miss out hanging with my family to stay in New York, so I could go to Philly to do this thing. So I'm sitting in their living room, and I'm kind of talking to their son, Asher, and hanging out, and I see a word on the book, and I'm like, okay, I should write a poem on here, so I chose a phrase from one of the books on their shelves and then started this poem. And then I was having a conversation with a friend who said the word fame index. And I was like, oh, wow, I like that. So I used that as the title. And the name of this poem is Blue Star Fame Index. And I wrote it at their place. It has nothing to do with your household.
I'm nervous.
Blue Star Fame Index, 1. Emergent occasions to order element from ideal height. How do you know about them? One implausible copy after another, sudden synthesis, or leavings from an acrophobe, quotable. 2. As destined to fail, as beauty, as fear, which is never final, to recurring astonishment, alone in a room, the theory goes as disappearance, as breathtaking, as sitting in a chair, ranking excursion, 2 as dramatic composition. 3. As if just because you didn't know it was there doesn't mean it wasn't there. And only, the minute I let you down, you'll know I'm in love with you. And only, if you'll help me with what really concerns you. 4. Symptoms stage in diaphanous scapes, a virtual amateur Blue Star Fame Index. 5. In other words, conditions.
And the last poem is one of my favorites and maybe one of your least favorites.
It's published in that the American Poet, the journal for the Academy of American Poets. It's called Fixed. After image, articulate reversals, religious and premise, technically, you love, contrast, reversal, tender men dressed in verse, all broad strokes, palms open, mouths soft, tonal systems, cinder block enmeshed under tarps, ruffled floral limits, verdigris, space illusion, circle line, mimetic curvature, dashing off because it's midnight, it's thirsty, it's color challenged. All arms, all reach, hollowed specter beneath sister, insufficient head thrown back, fix it in the mix, water everywhere, gone, lying here, stomach up, tongue out, big pretty letters on retina. Free studies, sketched evening, backpedaled paisleys, how do you say puel, or lip, or not tonight, vanishing boundaries, rushing back into weave, muscle, arteries per se, kissing pace, astounded by it.
From the newest work first, it's just the beginnings of a collaboration with Portia Munson, and it's just some writing in response to some of her images, to some of her mandalas, and so it's sort of at the beginning of the stage of the collaboration, and I'll probably read about 15-20 minutes. Coloring the glass with pee or peering at a blue dense enough to be alive or to influence a human action. The feathered death crown is a spiral, and in automatic writing, the spirals grow smaller and smaller before any actual communication. Spiral, a tornado wind in the pen and on the page. Pressed glass hen on nest grows in frosted petticoats, white darning apes, clear radio tubes, cobalt, wild eyewash cup. A blue glass talks of sand and heat. It speaks of tinctures and rubs, soothing as a salve or as beauty does. The sand grains talk of rock and water. The feather crowns say there must be a better way to signify heaven or salvation. Those who gather crowns keep them under glass, are in their best candy boxes, and pass them on as evidence of afterlife. This one gathers the living. The feathers haven't chosen a spokesman earth-shaken pressed glass pink and permanent petticoats arms pinned. The blind woman started the fire. She put something metal in the microwave. This was said inside a drugstore. A robot that you can have sex with, written on a grocery receipt. In the clouds, too. Voices everywhere. Two. Reading, returning items to the sea and beads to wire. Horseshoe crabs pushed back into time in hopes of reanimation. Many years ago lived a feather who storied about, oh, well, everything, age, even weight. As for fortune-telling, having no moral center, it pointed all over the place like a drunken planchette, giving misgivings about one's fate. The feather bird brain, but once a beauty and given liberties because of it, lost its looks due to drink and fast living. The feather blown over into the gutter and stolen by a beak for the down of a nest. She says in exasperation, he stories all the time. Lying feathers inside the pillow, black, white, or banded, power hungry, escape the ticking through the seams. Headdress of bread wrappers, I'll find a way to wear the fingers of a ruffled down feather. It laid inside other objects like a meteorite in a field of pussy willows, or like a rose crystal skull abandoned on a city sidewalk. A fossil is a fiction written by time. We transcribe tree rings for our notebooks while the earth shakes us down. X for an eye socket, jaw missing. Floats like a Pac-Man skull on the wall outside the train station. If not spirits, then who will bring us metaphors for our poems? Elephants bearing salt and pepper, trunks tied to a plastic pony's back, unyielding, brittle, and easy to snap, the bridled pony laden with packages tied tight with red string. Yet some fall and shatter as if they had arrived by mail. Bribed or beaten to walk at night over canyons and valleys of green sleep. Biscuit boxes and camping stoves are small but heavy like the stone houses of Hurley, moving through woods towards the big, deep fragment of an enameled bucket. Depression pink tongue tip, thick and scalloped, it radiates from the car in the woods. Hubcap pain spokes outwards from the center. Everyday pain is finished, the rough edged off, and spun into beauty, moving towards the center of the woods. A matchbox cemetery turns to stone over time. And then I read from a piece I've been called The Tatters that some of you might have heard before. It's also elegy, in a sense. Clean folded plate paper lying in street, a job request for urine. I close my eyes, a broth of steaming piss. Transmission while walking briskly, slightly ruffled, before bed, round butter cakes, going to bed, devil's food, bright red between sheets. On growing a perfect wing, I forgot about the purpose of flight or the cloak of a peacock. A wet pigeon said, why don't I ask for what I really want? I have forgotten the purpose of touching a child's hand. Pigeon shed on perfect feathers, deep brown cake pans. And taking it apart to see how it works, I realize that I wish to control the means of production. Cast iron pumped by muscle, pulleys and rope, linens climb in and out the window. This I recognize as cast iron circle and hemp. Rum-soaked cake, half-eaten on the table, to this we return. Dorothy Podbear's belongings on the sidewalk, charred wood, even though that building was never on fire. Diagrams of electrical machines, I like to look and don't care that I don't understand. I've lived a long time without knowing the names of the trees, barely able to recognize a locust leaf, and yet I can recognize the sight of oak, even varnished or cobbled into a desk or plank. I have lived here not knowing that a rock dove is a pigeon, of my apartment knowing only that the cockroaches are German and the rats Norwegian. None of this is good, and I worry about the scarcity of wood, or if we'll ever have enough materials to reassemble the object after taking it apart. I took apart a hornet's nest after my brother had sprayed it with heavy chemicals. In pursuit of the natural world, I cut a swath, a giant lifting boards and logs, uncovering sleeping animals or embryonic mice, worms, snakes, and salamanders all call me an asshole. Today, cast iron wood cooking stove pulled up from the basement, pinball machine, bubblegum machine filled with crumbling candy. Tonight, perhaps more of Dorothy Podbear's belongings, a wooden storage chest from below the street level. Rotten wood, earthy and soft, the color in the dark is dark, caramel and full of the night earth's products, like the rats who live below us, a nightshade of dark, not rotten yet full of the rot of newspapers, my contribution. I collect ephemera and revisit it gleaming when I'm alone making lists and piles by color or subject or time. Taking apart the nest, all in their beds of gray, I had to know, and then I had nothing. Clumps of paper, and the dead in their paper beds, hundreds, and my brother was mad. Yet this does not prevent me from asking, what's inside the trunk on the street? Picture postcards, soft porn, or hard sex toys? Looking at the ground, the tatters of the nest I destroyed, but how else could I know the nature of physical objects and of my body? I, a physical object, asks what's inside the body, the Mutter Museum and its collection of swallowed needles, fish hooks, and pennies. For a long time, looking and gazing, trying to know the nature of the physical, like the man who could balance jagged sea rocks one on top of another. He could know an object and if those boulders could be stacked as steady as plates or as delicately as a house of cards. I, a physical object, reading anatomy, 1924, colored plates, diagrams of overlays. It is good that I saved these thick books, each one a doorstopper on female anatomy and childcare, from the time of paper and print. Colored plates to lift and reveal, each plate like a candy pop, taking you further, dissolving layers until you reach the baby's soft center. Diagrams like this one, see? A man told me of finding the foot pedals of a sewing machine covered in dust on Mott Street, about how he put his foot to the pedal and the flywheel turned, although the rest of the machine was extinct. Flywheel, I like to say it and see it. Along with paper, or reading from paper, in a room, it's quiet. Me, a noun, an animal from the time of the animals. I write and I eat with my hands. Working late and decoding secret writings from the tatters. Read once of a wealthy young artist who slept in nests he made of bedding in luxury hotels. I thought a nest should be made from discards and humbled like a quilt. The feather again, the blade, this time on the street, first quietly in front, then as I move Cox quietly towards 10 o'clock position. Later in the day, silently soaked with winter salt. Two, same roach and rat, regulars. Can't recall the center, only the fury with which I tore it, then a drop in the blood at realizing what I had done. Paper at my feet, bodies, stillborns, what little I know of other lives. My father's workshop, wooden tables turned to rot, slumping tools, rods, belts, motors, intercepting messages barked up by Frank's box, or the poems of Hannah Wiener, and I follow my spirit guides, Bernadette Mayer and Brad Will. Bernadette is alive and has lots of books and papers. Bernadette eats an egg at her writing desk every morning. Poets build bookshelves. The worst part of poetry is the paperwork. Poems distract poets from thoughts of death. I know Bernadette is alive because she leaves eggshells on her writing desk. Brad is dead even though he used to eat fire. I have some of his objects which keep me from thoughts of his death. I lie. I have none of his objects, only a film of him breathing fire. Grandpa wrote his figures on panels of cigarette cartons, and I saved their clutter too, even the phone numbers. I won't erase them, thus keeping the database of phantoms alive. Wooden bowls feed me. Cup of tea makes me know I'm alive. If I were dead, I could not feel the heat of a cup or taste the bitter tannins. Cup of tea distracts me from my death and the death of everyone I love. Blood-stained napkin told of toothache. Cup of tea said I was alive. Seed pods lay crushed on the sidewalk. Rattan dining set told me to sit down and watch. Bulky coats feed the pigeons and squirrels. Chair legs ordered me to the desk to write of this. No feathers today, and putting a meal on the table is a great distraction. An office chair facing a mound of garbage bags tried to get my attention. Spirits of the chair and bag and of the bus hum on the avenue, and in the water fish sing the full glory of objects in the body. Man said delicious as I walked by. Later on, a conversation with Rebecca over the problem of dinner and care of food animals, even the winged bugs in a flower. About the feathers at my feet are feet. Even the homemade and the humble dream of white beads. How can I read the banana skin with its neck pointed down and away? Birds ignore me. Cigarette butts refuse to make eye contact. I might be dead after all. If I can live long enough to know, then I can start my making. Then I will really have something, like the man who mourned his dog. Until the dog's ashes arrived, he felt incomplete. Shaky since a child, I can thread a needle, but I cannot hold a rifle steady. At the Five Points Mission, a bodega door, green and ajar, asked me to come in. Today, April, a man on my stoop cradles a pigeon. The bird is calm and the man is full of madness. I look closely at them, gleams of purple in their cloaks, looking closer at the neighbor in the window in pink and on the phone, sitting on the edge of her bed. I wanted to write an elegy, but without the sadness.
July. It's a while down the road, but it's in July. I believe it's the 17th.
Wow.
But it should be a great meeting too, as this really was. So thank you all so much for coming out. There'll be a good jazz, you know, duo coming out next weekend if you want to hear that. But thank you so much. Thank you.